Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. This week I'm going to look at one of the most iconic of all Great Britain Rugby League tours to Australia and New Zealand, the 1946 Indomitables Tour. For the first time, this was a rugby league tour that was organised not just for football reasons, but which also had a political purpose too. It was explicitly arranged by the Australian Foreign Minister, H.V. Evatt, with the intention of celebrating the Allied victory in World War II, following the end of the Pacific War on the 15th of August 1945. Evatt was also a serious rugby league supporter. He had founded Sydney University Rugby League Club in 1919, and he wanted to use the sport to help re-establish the imperial link between Britain and Australia, which had become strained after 1942 when, following the fall of Singapore to the Japanese, many Australians believed that the British government had abandoned them. Initially, the Rugby Football League turned down the suggestion because it believed that the logistics of sending a team to Australia so soon after the war would be insurmountable. Rationing was still in force, transport was scarce, and shipping was reserved for essential military supplies and demobbed servicemen. So in October 1945, Evatt interrupted his journey to America, where he was due to address the opening assembly of the United Nations, to meet with the RFL Council in Manchester and persuade them that a tour could be organised. Evatt was also one of the most outstanding Australian politicians of the 20th century, having been a High Court judge at just 36 years old, the first President of the United Nations General Assembly, and later the leader of the Australian Labour Party during the 1950s. He told the Rugby Football League that the close relationships that have been built up between Australia and New Zealand and the north of England is in the nature of a history, and the building up of this history ought to be resumed as soon as possible in the best interests of rugby league football and of the British Empire. When they heard Evatt's speech, the members of the RFL Council changed their mind, and through his government contacts, arrangements were made for a Lions team to travel on the HMS Indomitable, an aircraft carrier that was being used as a troop carrier for demobilised soldiers. And so the 1946 Lions would be nicknamed the Indomitables. Britain in 1946 was still struggling with the after effects of World War II. The RFL issued each player with a trunk to carry their belongings down under with them, but most players, including the Lions captain Gus Risman, had trouble filling it. The war had ended, yet rationing was still in operation. Clothing could only be bought if one had the right coupons, and that also included sports equipment. "I have found it difficult to obtain sufficient clothing for the trip," Gus told the Daily Dispatch. "My football boots have been patched so often that there are now more patches than the original leather on the uppers." Ethel Risman, his wife, said, "It's been an awful job. I have patched and darned so that Gus could save his coupons for the tour, but we have barely managed to scrape through." After 4 weeks on the Indomitable, the tourists arrived in Fremantle on the west coast of Australia, 2,500 miles from their destination in Sydney, and had to take a 3-day train journey across the Nullarbor Desert. "There were no facilities for sleep on this train, which was under military control," reported tour manager William Gabbett. "Prior to departure, a knife, fork, spoon and military blanket were issued to each player. We were ordered to keep our compartments clean and tidy. There were morning inspections by the officer in charge." When the Lions finally arrived in Sydney, they were treated as returning heroes and symbols of hope. The weekly Rugby League News welcomed them with the declaration that "Rugby League, with justifiable pride, always emphasises the fact that it is the most democratic of all sports." The New South Wales Rugby League presented each tourist with a food parcel worth £1, which included tin butter, cheese, lard and dripping, all of which are vitally needed, so that they could send these provisions home to their families who were suffering from the shortages of post-war Britain. Some of this sympathy for Britain disappeared as soon as the test matches kicked off. The novelist Thomas Keneally remembered how the performance of the enormous British props, Kenji and Frank Whitcomb, caused the people at the Sydney Cricket Ground in 1946 to cry, "That's it, no more bloody food parcels for Britain." As well as the big cities of Sydney and Brisbane, the tourists visited what Australians call country towns. In Junee, Orange, Bundaberg and Rockhampton, shops closed and a day's holiday was declared so the entire population of the town could attend their local team's match against the Lions. Gifts of food parcels containing local produce were also a regular feature of these matches. During the course of the tour, Bradford's Jack Kitchen managed to send 20 parcels back home for his family and relatives. These incredible welcomes for the Lions wherever they went were partly a celebration of the end of the war, but they also reaffirmed the imperial link between Britain and what most Aussies still called home. When the Lions played at Rockhampton, the match programme announced, "Welcome England, to you, ambassadors from the mother country. We extend a generous and wholehearted welcome." Even so, Australia was in the midst of industrial conflict, and a coal shortage caused public transport to be cancelled on the day of the second Test match in Brisbane. And despite the warmth of this welcome, the Test matches were as fierce and as competitive as anything that had gone before. In the first Test match, over 64,000 fans saw a 12-man Britain haul the Australians to an 8-all draw after Bradford schoolteacher Jack Kitchen had been sent off for allegedly punching Australian captain Joe Jorgensen. At the second Test in Brisbane, the crowd arrived so early that the gates were locked at 10 a.m, fully 5 hours before the match kicked off, and they saw Lions victory by 14 points to 5, despite hooker Joe Egan being sent off for punching the notorious Aussie second rower Arthur Clues. For the third Test, the teams returned to the Sydney Cricket Ground, where the Australians found themselves overwhelmed by 20 points to 7. Their cause was not helped when Arthur Clues was sent off early in the second half for a high tackle on Gus Risman. The near whitewashing of Australia perhaps signalled the start of a change in the way the Australians played the game. As Thomas Keneally again recalled, "We were in part educated by the Poms. Their big forwards made a science of gaining the hard yards up the middle, purely as a prelude to sending the ball wide to their backs." When Great Britain returned in 1950, the Ashes were won by Australia for the first time in 30 years. After winning the Ashes series in Sydney, the Lions then travelled to New Zealand, where a tired team surprisingly lost the single Test match against New Zealand 13 points to 8, thanks to 5 Warwick Clark goals at a rain-soaked Carlow Park. A week earlier, Auckland Dockers had gone on strike for 3 hours so that they could watch Auckland play England at Carlow Park, after the Docks management had refused to give them time off to go to the game. After 27 matches, the Lions boarded the New Zealand passenger liner Rangitiki to cross the Pacific for the first leg of their journey home. Intriguingly, when they arrived in North America, Gus Risman and Jack Kitchen asked the managers if they could organise an exhibition match in New York. The managers turned down the idea, but as it turned out, there was a dock strike in New York anyway, and the tourists went to Halifax in Nova Scotia to catch a ship back across the Atlantic. The 1946 tour was not only a massive success on the pitch, but it also made a record profit of more than £9,500. From this, the players were paid an average of £143 in wages, depending on whether they had dependents at home, and a bonus of around £123 each. Knowing how successful the tour was, the players asked the managers for an increase in their one-third share of the profits when they were on the New Zealand leg of the tour. But yet again, the management turned them down and instead organised another match against Auckland to finish the tour off. The players also asked for compensation for damage that had been done to their clothes and belongings on the long train journey across the Nullarbor Desert, but this too was turned down. And although they did not know it, while the players earned an average of around about £270 for their efforts on the tour, the two tour managers, William Gabbett and Walter Popplewell, were each paid £400 in wages by the RFL. Even so, it's also interesting to consider that a number of the British tourists were approached by Sydney clubs to play in Australia. For example, Wakefield Trinity forward Harry Murphy, who dislocated his shoulder on the first match and didn't play in another tour game, was offered £9 a week by Balmain, plus a £300 signing on fee. He turned it down because he felt he could earn more by staying in England. And in fact, 4 of the star Australian players who had played in the 1946 Ashes series, Arthur Clues, Lionel Cooper, Pat Devery and George Watt, came over to play in England the following year. How times have changed. The tour eventually came to an end on the 23rd of September, when, 6 weeks after they left Wellington on the Rangitiki, the tourist finally arrived at Tilbury Docks. As he left the ship, backup scrum half Di Jenkins received a telegram from his club, Leeds, telling him that he'd been selected to play for them the very next day. He didn't make it to the match. The railways were still operating on a wartime basis, and it was impossible to get back to Leeds in time. But the telegram was a signal that the great Indomitables adventure of 1946 was over. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode of the Rugby Reloaded podcast. As I'm sure you know by now, my Twitter handle is @ColinsTony and my website is www.rugbyreloaded.com, where you can find the complete archives of all the episodes, along with the show notes and links for this episode. Until next week, thanks for listening.